You know, I think in the U.S., we've sort of, a lot of religious traditions have sort of emphasized belief a lot. You know, I think if you go back historically, being a religious person has often meant a lot more about belonging to a church, belonging to a community than believing in something. So I think for whatever reasons, we've elevated believing. And I know we have the creeds and whatnot, so belief has always been a big part of religious traditions, don't get me wrong, but there's a way in which, you know, being part of a community, committing to that community, participating in that community, you know, these are the things that, this is what it means to be a religious person.
Mark Eaton is professor of American literature at Azusa Pacific University, and also, since 2015, editor of the journal Christianity and Literature, now in its 70th year. Last year, Mark published Religion and American Literature Since 1950, a book that shows how prominent American novelists portray America's evolving religious landscape. We talk about the complexity of religion in modern America, literature's engagement of that complexity, and the challenges of belief that confront us all. I'm Matthew Wickman, founding director of the BYU Humanities Center. Mark Eaton, former guest of the BYU Humanities Center. Good to see you again over Zoom, Mark.
Thanks so much for having me, Matthew. And yeah, it's great to be back with you.
It's my pleasure. When you were here, you were talking to us about the book about to come out, and now that book is in print. Now, I usually ask our guests how they imagine their faith in the context of their life and work. In your case, I think I'll defer that question until a bit later, because your book, and this book is titled Religion and American Literature Since 1950, this book illustrates why that question about faith can be a complex one. So in that spirit, let's start with your book. First, I'll just ask you a fairly straightforward question. Can you tell us about the inception of the project?
Yeah, so I had done a essay about Don DeLillo and sort of apocalyptic thinking. And it came out in one of the Modern Language Association approaches to teaching Don DeLillo. So it was a really great volume. And that chapter just got me thinking about, you know, the way that contemporary writers like DeLillo and others were writing about religion and spirituality. And, you know, in that case, I was sort of thinking through DeLillo being a post-Catholic writer in a sense. And, you know, so then I just got to thinking about writers like James Baldwin, Flannery O'Connor, and lots of others who end up in the book. And it kind of developed into a project. But I would say the starting point was Don DeLillo and thinking about him as a kind of writer who was interested in describing what was going on in the religious landscape in America.
Yeah, I did not realize DeLillo did that as much as he does, and does it so vividly. And we'll get to that in a little bit. I learned that, Mark, from your book. I'd read DeLillo, but it hadn't registered with me the way you bring it out. You wrote about this book, this really various perspectives onto religion from different writers in the American literary tradition from 1950 forward. Have you always, since you've been a scholar, seen yourself as a scholar of religion and literature, or was that a specialization you acquired once you were a few years into your career?
It was kind of a specialization that I acquired. You know, my dissertation was more about writers in Hollywood in the 1930s and 40s. Yeah. And, you know, so I was writing much more about kind of literature and popular culture. And so I think that turning to religion and literature was a kind of move where I really had sort of ramp up and read a lot more in theology. I had to read a lot more in religious studies, religious history. But that was really energizing for me because I come out of a religious tradition myself. You know, I grew up in the Presbyterian church. I went to a small Christian liberal arts college, Whitworth College, now Whitworth University up in Spokane, Washington. So looking back now, Matthew, I really see it as, you know, kind of me at a certain point in my career, kind of trying to reconnect with my roots and understand them a little bit better. And maybe, you know, also kind of understand my roots in the context of U.S. religious history. because I really am looking at, you know, sort of religion through literature in a very historical and kind of cultural way in this book.
Yeah, you are. That's an interesting story, Mark. I don't think we talked about that when you were here before, about how you got into this field. So when you go back to try to get in touch with these roots, have you found that your work as a scholar has helped you clarify those roots, or has your work as a scholar complicated all of that?
I think it's helped. Well, I would actually say both in a lot of ways. Now that I you know, that's a good way of putting the question. I mean, it complicates it in the sense that, you know, I'm in this book looking at a lot of different religious traditions than the one I grew up in. You know, Presbyterians are sort of a Reformed Protestant, you know, branch of Christianity. But in the book, I'm looking at Catholic writers, I'm looking at Jewish writers, I'm looking at, you know, Pentecostal writers, which is really what James Baldwin kind of grew up in. So in that sense, it really broadened my perspective of sort of where my own faith tradition fits into the broader religious landscape of the United States. But then again, it also clarified, you know, sort of who I am for me as well, just because I was able to see, oh, that's, you know, that's kind of where my own church tradition is coming from. You know, that's how it's maybe different than others. And I gained an appreciation for, you know, I think Protestants, it can be a very cerebral, kind of almost intellectual faith. And as an intellectual and a literature scholar, but also as a religious person, it kind of helped me understand how I was able to kind of balance those two things.
Well, that's great. And we just talked with a man named Belden Lane, a scholar. He's a theologian, now emeritus from St. Louis University. He described himself as a recovering scholar. He's now retired.
Yeah.
And he talked about the difference between some kind of religious experience versus the knowledge of religious experience you find at universities. And those are not quite the same thing, right? He talked about that. Let's move in the direction now of your book, this really wonderful book that came out last year, 2020. You know, your book takes up what Charles Taylor calls the Nova effect, right? Yes. The explosion of religious diversity in the modern world, and especially given the fragmentation of traditional institutional religions, right? The kind of the pluralization of religions. You show how American novelists of the late 20th and early 21st centuries address this landscape of religions that's both institutional and kind of eclectic and new age. Yeah. Taylor comes at this as a philosopher and an intellectual historian.
Right.
You are a literary historian, and I'm curious here what you think the literary angle onto the subject enabled you to think in ways that might be difficult even for an intellectualist like Taylor. Did your literary training, how did it open the project? Did you find that it did make it difficult for you to address parts of it? I mean, how did the literary factor enter in here?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. You know, Taylor is kind of trying to give an account, a sort of genealogy, if you will, of secularization and how religion persists. And in fact, you know, with the Nova effect, religion is almost kind of splintering and fragmenting into lots of different things. You have new religious movements, et cetera. So he's kind of describing that as, you know, a historian, as a theorist of secularization. But I think the advantage of coming at it through literature is that, you know, literature really relies on the interiority of characters, for example, kind of getting inside the minds of these characters. And also, you know, it's sort of rooted in everyday life, right? So to my mind, the advantage that literature brings is that it really allows us to almost see religious experience on the ground. You know, what does it look like? And how are people grappling with their own beliefs and, you know, with their relationship to religious institutions, et cetera. So it really is more coming at these things from a kind of lived religion sort of perspective. And I was pushed a little bit about this question, Matthew, by the reviewers for the press.
Oh, really?
So when I got the peer reviews back, one reviewer in particular said, well, you know, why literature instead of, you know, autobiographies, or why literature instead of, you know, other types of writing? What, you know, what exactly is it that that literature provides? And so my answer, which I think I have kind of managed to foreground even better in the book, is that literature brings these kind of techniques of interiority where you really are seeing minds in motion, you know, minds, you know, trying to wrestle with big questions and what they think about these things, how they are practicing and putting their faith into practice. So those are what writers kind of are showing in their fiction.
I found it fascinating to read. And you know, you really do discuss a diversity of writers here, a diversity of religious perspectives, diversity of literary styles, and seeing sure. how that sort of plays in, as you point out, kind of religious experience on the ground, you know, or this yeah. lived religious yeah. quality to it, that really communicates itself. Maybe what we can do, I mean, the book is very, very rich. There's a lot of great stuff in here. So we're not going to do, we can't, this is not a 4-hour part podcast, alas, Mark, but maybe yeah. we could give like a little bit of a brief overview of a few of the chapters and some sure. of the themes you discuss. Chapter one, you take up Flannery O'Connor and apostasy. Can you describe yeah. that chapter yeah. a little bit for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I was noticing and reading Flannery O'Connor's short stories, also her two novels, that these characters are often kind of pushing against religious belief, and they're running away. They're apostates, if you will, in the sense that they're trying to leave the church. You know, so for example, Hazel Motes, in, you know, her first novel, Wiseblood, is trying to form this new church without God. And so since Flannery O'Connor herself, you know, is always a really strong religious believer and very steadfast in her faith, I had to kind of figure out, what is she doing here? So my theory is that Flannery O'Connor is showing the ways in which you can't run away from God. God sort of is always, you know, kind of in pursuit, if you will. And so these apostate characters in her fiction end up being what I call failed apostates, because mm-hmm. they really can't, in the end, reject, you know, what they truly believe. And so often in her fiction, you know, it's violence or it's extreme situations that push these characters towards accepting God's grace. And so that's, you know, that's kind of the chapter in a nutshell.
Okay. And these are often very extreme situations in O'Connor's fiction. You know, yeah. there's a yeah. real strong connection there between grace and violence, grace and yeah. the grotesque. It's fascinating. She's a fascinating writer.
Right.
I was really moved in reading this. I did, you know, I've read O'Connor's, much of her fiction, and I've read some criticism on it, but you sure. brought out a couple places in correspondence of hers. She talks about how she feels tormented by the fact that she was such a strong believer in God, but she was convinced she was writing for people who were convinced that God is dead. And you can see yeah. that kind of torment playing out in how she constructs and frames these yeah. stories and characters.
Yeah, it's true. That's the other sort of prong of my argument in that chapter, is that O'Connor is writing in the 50s and then the 1960s. And she really is sort of assuming that her audience is becoming more and more secular. And so there's a way in which she's trying to kind of, you know, shake up those readers, but she's also trying to shake up, you know, her religious readers too, her Christian readers as well. And it's like she's trying to shake everyone out of their complacency, you know, right. out of sort of not taking these things seriously enough. And that's what she sees happening in sort of 1950s America, is this kind of, you know, bland sort of anything goes faith. And she wants people to kind of get back to, you know, the real, you know, doctrines that she believes so strongly in.
Right. Yeah, good. You follow that chapter with a chapter on James Baldwin.
Right.
And here the key word is not apostasy, but conversion.
That's right.
Can you explain that convergence?
The conversion part of this chapter, you know, mainly has to do with the scene in Go Tell It on the Mountain, which is James Baldwin's first novel, but also just a masterpiece. It's one of the great first novels, I think, by any American writer. I guess Invisible Man by Ralph Ellison would be the other, you know,
yeah,
true
good.
Masterpiece that's a first novel. But, you know, by the end of that book, what we see is that the main character, John Grimes, who is based on James Baldwin himself, has this incredible sort of conversion experience in this storefront Pentecostal church in Harlem. It's sort of an all-night, you know, prayer service where he experiences this, you know, pretty incredible conversion. And so part of what Baldwin is doing is just trying to kind of describe what that type of conversion looks like and feels like. It's like a bodily experience where his whole body is taken over by the Holy Spirit. And it's a form of religious ecstasy as well. So I think that in itself is interesting. But then when you think about that book and all of Baldwin's, you know, nonfiction in the context of his career, what you see is that, you know, Baldwin himself started out as a preacher as a very young man, as a teenager, in fact. He was a preacher in this Pentecostal church. But as he moves into becoming a writer and turning towards literature, what he's doing is he's sort of bringing his religious experiences with him. He's writing about them as an insider, if you will. And he's writing, you know, really powerful fiction about religious experience.
Right. And in fact, you remark that Baldwin, even though he sort of leaves his early religious tradition behind, he does develop a very strong political and aesthetic vision that draws on that religious experience, even if he renounces formal religious affiliation. And that's kind of a theme in your book, right? That people remain attached to religion, even in the process of nominally leaving it behind.
That's right. So in Baldwin's case, I think he very self-consciously and deliberately kind of uses religious language. He kind of adopts this almost prophetic sort of voice when he's talking about, you know, race relations in America in the 50s and 60s. So it's almost like he becomes a kind of American prophet, if you will. You know, he's engaging with the secular world, but he brings this religious language and this religious knowledge, and he keeps using it throughout his career, even though I think it's fairly safe to say he's no longer a believer. You know, what he sort of believes in, you know, in his literary career is love. And he understands love in this very religious way, but that's sort of what he puts his faith in. And just, you know, real quickly, the next chapter is about secular Jewish writers who are also, as writers, putting their Jewish roots behind them. And yet they too can't really get rid of these ways of thinking about the world. And, you know, these religious traditions kind of keep inserting themselves into their work, into their ways of thinking.
That's right. Yeah, this chapter, that next chapter kind of changes gears a little bit in that you take up three writers and not just the one. It's Saul Bellow, Philip Roth, and E.L. Doctorow. Yeah. And you use, this is really provocative term that you use to sort of engage them. The term is secular theodicy.
Yeah.
So that requires a bit of explanation. Okay, so.
Good. Yeah, absolutely. I'm so pleased that you've picked up on how each chapter, you know, is mainly focused on a single writer. This chapter is focused on three writers, but notice that each chapter also takes up a concept in theology. So with Flannery O'Connor, it's apostasy. With James Baldwin, it's conversion. And with the chapter on these three Jewish writers, it's theodicy. So basically, theodicy is sort of that branch of theology that tries to kind of reconcile the notion of a just and good God with the prevalence of evil in the world. You know, if God is good, if God is sovereign, why then would he allow the Holocaust to happen? And for Jewish writers, I think the Holocaust is certainly what looms large. It was, you know, the Holocaust was one of the things that spurred the sort of God is dead theological movement. And so these Jewish writers are very much engaging with theodicy. But they're doing it, I argue, in this kind of secular way, where they're trying to use theodicy to show that we can't really rely on God anymore. But God nonetheless is kind of a constant presence, a constant interlocutor, if you will, in their work.
Yeah, and I thought that it was really interesting how you brought that out and these three writers, because it's different in the three, but there is that thematic through line for all three with that kind of secular question about how do you explain the existence of evil, of suffering. You also point out, I think this is really interesting, that the way that these secular writers, you know, Bellow, Roth, Doctorow, work out these questions, it's different than the way it is for a lot of American Christians, especially when you think about evangelicals, that the Jewish writers here looked on the formation of the state of Israel not as a herald to a coming Messiah, but as, I'm quoting here, you say, as the most militant and ultimately secular means to prevent further persecution, right? So the state of Israel for them, very different than it is for many Americans who get, you know, exercised about what happens in Israel.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think in the context of what's happening recently with Israel sort of battling with Hamas, I think your point is well taken, that these Jewish writers do kind of come down on the side of Israel defending itself, you know, as a secular state and wanting to preserve its sovereignty against all challengers. And So that's true. Of course, those politics in the Middle East are quite complicated.
Oh, man.
And the writers themselves get caught up in these kind of tangled tangled arguments about it.
Yeah, I'll say. I'm going to come back to one of them, Doctorow, later, because the way he engages it, way you bring that out, I think is really provocative and worthy of a question. But let me ask you about your last chapter. This is Don DeLillo now, kind of where the project began, as you say. And the concept here is the concept of eschatology.
Yeah, so eschatology is sort of the branch of theology that has to do with last things. You know, what will unfold in the end times. And this is, you know, Catholics have sort of a longstanding interest in eschatology. So it's probably no coincidence that DeLillo, who grew up in the Catholic Church, attended Catholic schools, you know, went to Fordham University, which is a Jesuit university. Probably no coincidence that he kind of has this interest in eschatology and apocalyptic kinds of scenarios. So again, he's sort of coming at these things from the standpoint of a writer who is really trying to just sort of survey what is going on in the world today. And DeLillo, you know, he writes about religious cults. He writes about, you know, all sorts of new religious movements. But he, at the same time, kind of keeps coming back to, you know, especially in Underworld, one of his late novels, he keeps coming back to the Bronx and the kind of very, you know, ethnically mixed, but very Catholic neighborhoods that he grew up in the Bronx in the 1950s. And I just find him a fascinating writer.
Oh, he is. Way. Yeah, but you moved me to begin reading DeLillo. I've read White Noise and I read Falling Man, and you know, I'm not a contemporary Americanist by training, but I've been moved to sort of pick him up again because of your book. Yeah. You know, he writes so powerfully about how we invest even banal everyday things with religious energies. Yeah, it struck me that it's hard to walk away from his fiction without feeling a little queasy about one's beliefs, but also without realizing that belief is ubiquitous, you know, whether you want to or not, right? DeLillo, it seems, makes everybody uncomfortable, which is one of his real remarkable traits as a writer. No one is left without feeling as though they have some thinking to do.
Yeah, it's true. He's some critics have called him a social novelist, you know, in the sense that he's writing about the sort of totality of our society. And you're absolutely right. I think one of his insights is that people almost need belief in some higher purpose, you know, some sort of larger purpose to our lives. So even as they're, you know, going about the business of living their everyday lives, they're searching for something else. So, you know, and they start to kind of find these moments of transcendence or these kind of intimations of something beyond our everyday reality. They find these in the weirdest places, you know, like, you know, the dad who hears his daughter in a dream start, you know, whispering things, or, you know, or even like he's at the cash machine, getting out the ATM machine, getting out cash, and he feels sort of blessed by the machine. Right. So he's really good at sort of showing, you know, those sorts of moments people are in awe, something beyond.
Yeah. Can I quote that? The dad hears the daughter. It's just, yeah. you quote it. It's on page 174 of your book, but this is great. This is DeLillo here. You're quoting, Steffi turned slightly, then muttered something in her sleep. It seemed important that I know what it was. I sat there watching her. Moments later, she spoke again. Distant syllables this time, but a language not quite of this world that seemed to have ritual meanings. Part of a verbal spell or ecstatic chant. Toyota Celica.
Yeah.
You know, it's really fun. I mean, he's really good at getting into kind of the mindset of kind of a religious experience, of quite heightened power, and then attaching it to everyday, sometimes often very ridiculous thing. I mean, Toyota Celica is hardly the substance here of religious vision or ecstatic trance.
Yeah, exactly. And another example of that kind of thing you're talking about is in Underworld, where they see a billboard for Minute Maid orange juice or something. And all of a sudden they see a vision of this girl that had died in the projects named Esmeralda.
Right.
And it's considered a sort of miraculous vision of this young girl. And everybody comes to see it, et cetera.
That's right. So I really like your book, Mark. And I think
it makes an
important contribution to the field of religion and literature. I've got to say, though, it captures a tension between religious belief and unbelief that I find a little uncanny. I consider myself a religious person who's also a scholar, or to put it in a different way, I belong to a religion and I also belong to the profession of literary studies. And your book strikes me as a drama about the tensions of belonging to those two things, right? Two things that seem in some ways to be in conflict with each other, or at least don't always sit easily alongside each other. Do you experience this tension yourself? Is it a personal matter for you like it is for me? Or is it something that you've managed to observe more just as a cultural fact?
Yeah, that's a very profound question. I think it is true that, you know, I think a lot of religious people, whether they're professors or not, whether they're in academia or not, maybe just their work environment is much more secular. So I think as religious individuals, we often do kind of live in these worlds that are in tension, you know, the more secular world of our work, for example, and then the, as you say, belonging to a church, belonging to a religious tradition. And so I think those things are in tension sometimes, but one of the things I think religious believers are pretty good at is sort of code switching, if you will, of sort of moving in and out of those worlds. And in fact, that's one of the things I'm kind of trying to describe in this book, is the way that people are pretty fluid and pretty good at sort of reconciling the different worlds that they inhabit. At the same time, though, I would add, Matthew, that, you know, I think in the U.S., we've sort of a lot of religious traditions have sort of emphasized belief a lot. And, you know, I think if you go back historically, being a religious person has often meant a lot more about belonging to a church, belonging to a community, than believing in something. So I think for whatever reasons, we've kind of elevated believing. And I know we have the creeds and whatnot. So belief has always been a big part of religious traditions. Don't get me wrong. But there's a way in which, you know, being part of a community, committing to that community, participating in that community, you know, these are the things that, this is what it means to be a religious person as well.
It's not
just about belief, if that makes sense.
It does make sense. I'm glad you make that point, Mark. When I was an undergraduate, so I work at BYU, I was also an undergraduate here back in the day, and it used to strike me as being quite remarkable that I could walk across campus. Yeah. It's you know, 30,000 plus students at BYU. It's not a small college. It's a large university. But I could feel like there was something I had in common with every other person on the campus, even if I didn't know who they were, had never met them, would never see them again.
Exactly.
And it is that sense of belonging that I think does describe at least the experience of religion. more than just abstractions of belief, you know, how much do I believe in X or Y doctrine today?
Exactly.
Let's transition then here to where I usually begin these conversations about asking you about faith. And the podcast is titled Faith and Imagination. I'm interested in how people who write and speak in important ways about religion and faith and matters of spirituality, how they imagine faith in their context of their life and their work. So how do you imagine faith in the context of your life and work?
I try to look at my own faith, you know, and my life sort of holistically as all, you know, of a piece. I mean, I'm a very quiet believer in some ways anyways. I'm, you know, kind of half introvert, half very social extrovert person. So I kind of just try to be who I am and kind of live authentically as a believer in whatever I'm doing. And so, you know, what that means for me is that I'm not often, you know, in a position where I'm proselytizing or representing my faith, but I'm living it out, if that makes sense. To the extent that I can, I sort of try to see it as integrated, you know, fully with my profession, with my scholarship, with my writing. But, you know, sometimes there can be tensions, you know, that you kind of feel. But I try to sort of see it as holistically as a part of who I am. And so that's kind of how I approach it.
I like that, Mark, a lot. You know, it reminds me, actually, my dad was a lawyer, you know, not a scholar like I am, but he worked as a corporate attorney in San Diego. Yeah. And I, for a few summers, I was a courier. I'd go between law offices. And once in a while, I'd find myself in an elevator alone with some attorney at one of these, you know, law firms downtown. And once in a while, I'd ask, I'd get in conversation and I'd say, oh, man, my dad works at a different law firm. And they'd say, oh, yeah, which firm? I'd tell him, he'd go, oh, really? Well, what's his name? I'd say my dad's name. Well, that's Lance Bickman. Mm-hmm. And they'd say, oh, no kidding. That's the most ethical person I've ever met in the law. Or that's the kindest person I've met. And it was just, it wasn't my dad proselytizing. It was just authentic living. And those who can live authentically are those I admire. It's not always been super easy for me in a you know, postmodern soul in a postmodern world, you know, but I admire you can do that. Let me turn here. We got about now maybe 7 minutes or so minutes left. I want to talk to you about your role as the editor of the journal Christianity and Literature. This is a prominent journal in the field of religion and literature. Love to have your perspective on the state of the field of religion and literature. Have you noticed anything important changing over the last decade in the field? Or is it now kind of what it was 10 years ago? Are there new things kind of coming onto the horizon that you can see from your vantage point?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. I became the editor of Christianity Literature in 2015. So I'm now, you know, 5 years into it. And, you know, I guess I would say that over the last 10, maybe even 15, 20 years, I think the field of Christianity and literature, of religion and literature, has in some ways taken a historical turn, a cultural turn. So I would say that's one prominent trend, is that in some ways, that's making Christianity and literature scholarship kind of more mainstream. So, you know, we're getting articles for our journal that could easily appear in PMLA, you know, or Modern Fiction Studies. So in a way, that's really great. But I think then there is, I think, also in Christianity and literature scholarship, the type of scholarship that is, you know, that is more concerned with theology, kind of the theology and literature approach. And so while there is in fact, a journal called Literature and Theology that's published by Oxford University Press and edited by Mark Knight,
a friend,
we get a lot of submissions in kind of that subfield as well, sort of theology and literature. But I would say that one trend is that the work has become more historical, kind of trying to contextualize writers, religious writers, in their historical moment.
Okay, that's interesting. That actually rings true to me too, as I kind of think about my own understanding of the field. And I'm not the editor of the journal like you are, but I do read widely in it, and that does seem to be consistent with what I've seen. So that prompts this question, and maybe it's a question that's impossible to answer, but you can tell me that. I'll ask it. Does the best work that appears in the journal that you edit, Christianity and Literature, does it resemble the best work in other, you know, journals in the broad field of literary studies? Or is there, or should there be something a little different about the best work in your journal as a function of its subject matter?
Yeah, I think that probably there is something that, you know, people who are writing about religion and literature, that work is distinctive in some ways from the kind of very secular work that appears in other journals. I mean, I would sort of answer two ways. I mean, we always want people who submit to our journal to be really engaged with what's going on in their field and what's going on in the larger profession. You know, so for example, I would like to see a lot more scholars of Christianity and literature dealing with people like Rita Felsky, you know, and sort of post-critique that whole movement. I would like to see scholars keeping up with those developments and engaging with those developments. But at the same time, as you're suggesting, I think there is something distinctive to thinking through literature, thinking about religion through literature. And it sort of requires, in some ways, people being somewhat well-versed in, you know, theological debates, theological concepts. So, you know, being informed about those things is sort of a prerequisite for writing about them well.
Yeah, absolutely. Something I appreciate about the best work that appears in the journal Christianity and Literature, and there's a lot of really good work that appears in it. You do a really great job, Mark. You really do.
Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate that the best work in it seems really smart to me, right? And it is very informed and it's up to date and they're very good readings of literary texts and all the things you associate with good scholarship. But there's also a sense sometimes that this stuff really bears on life, that it really impacts how we think and feel about the world, how we believe, how we live, who we want to become, so that I don't leave it saying, oh, that was interesting as an abstraction. I say to myself, that makes me think and feel something that bears on me differently. I appreciate about the best work that appears in your journal, at least as I assess it.
Well, that's good to hear, because that is one thing we push our authors on is, you know, what is the takeaway here? You know, what are readers, you know, supposed to learn from this? And so, we tend to not want articles that are very insular and kind of inward looking or just devoted to some arcane, you know, debate in Edmund Spencer studies or something. We want articles to be, you know, kind of more engaged and a little bit broader.
Has your work with the journal made you a better scholar, do you think? So sitting there, you mentioned Rita Felsky. When she was out here at BYU a few years ago, we talked about her work. At the time, she was the editor of one of the big journals in the field, New Literary History, and she was talking about the ways that being an editor had given her a different perspective onto the field. Same question to you. Has your work as the editor of the journal made you a better scholar or even just a different one?
I would say so, yes. I mean, I'm much more attuned to the ways that authors stake their claims in articles and sort of state them up front. And then the whole process of peer review too, you know, it helps to get really good reviewers say things like, this article is trying to do too much, you know, and I've really grown to appreciate peer review because these are scholars that are doing this work and they do it well. So yes, just that example of seeing the best articles. And the other thing I would add, Matthew, is that I also see as a journal editor this sort of developmental role, because oftentimes we get submissions from younger scholars or even from graduate students. And through the peer review process, you know, we're really helping them become better scholars, become better writers themselves. And I would almost venture to say that the majority of our submissions, you know, need some work. So we're giving these authors a chance to revise and resubmit, and they end up being better articles for it.
Yeah, which is good. And that's, you know, that's really important formative experience for any writer, including those who are already established, right?
Exactly.
Very few people do not benefit from peer review. This is a truism in the profession.
True.
Let me close with this question here. It's just thinking about kind of where you're at. You know, you're an accomplished scholar. You know, you've made a real contribution to your field. 10 years from now, would you like anything to be different about your scholarly life and or your religious life? Where do you see yourself, you know, ahead one more decade?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. I might start off by just pointing out that we're putting together a special issue right now in the journal called The Future of Literary Studies.
Oh, nice.
And so one of the things we've done is we've solicited articles from kind of Christian scholars in the secular academy or and at confessional or Christian schools to contribute. And so they're addressing questions like, you know, where is literary studies heading? You know, what about this crisis in humanities that everybody's talking about? So I don't know, Matthew. I mean, I sort of see myself in a position where I'm kind of mid-career, maybe a little bit beyond mid-career. You know, one thing that's happening is getting invited to do things like this. I feel like as more of a senior scholar, I'm kind of playing a little bit more of a public intellectual role, and I'm enjoying that. And, you know, maybe that'll keep happening. I'm going to continue with the journal for sort of one more five-year term. So we're really kind of seeing in 4 or 5 years from now the end of that too. But meanwhile, I've got a book that I'm editing on called Historical Fiction Now that is going to come out with Oxford University Press. And I've got other projects sort of in the works. So I see myself very much kind of continuing to do the kind of work I'm doing now and for a little bit longer anyway.
It's excellent work. I'll ask that last part of that question too. In your religious life, do you see
Sure.
yourself being someplace different in 10 years or in the same, or continuing on the same kind of path?
Yeah, I talked earlier about, you know, kind of being part of a community and kind of the commitment and the belonging part of my religious faith that's so important to me. And yeah, I would just say that I've been part of the same church for 20 years. And, you know, we've considered going to other churches, but we felt like, you know, we have lots of friends there. We have this community. We're part of this community. And, you know, for whatever flaws that any religious community has, you know, sticking with it is kind of important. So I think for the moment anyway, we have been very much committed to our church. And, you know, going forward, I think that living my faith and being committed to it will continue. I could see us, you know, possibly moving to a different church at some point, but it would be a very deliberative sort of, you know, decision for us because we really value being part of a community too.
Yeah, great. Well, I am grateful to be part of your community of friends, Mark.
Yeah,
thank you for taking the time to talk with us. Thanks for your excellent work in the field and all best wishes for a productive and pleasant summer.
Well, I have to thank you again for having me. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, Matthew, and I've always been impressed with you as a networker and kind of bringing people together. So keep up the good work that you're doing at the Humanities Center and in your own scholarship as well.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the BYU Humanities Center and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University and is produced and edited by Brooke Brown and Abby Thatcher. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes or would like to know more about the BYU Humanities Center, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.